Wednesday, April 19th, the battleship Iowa is taking part in naval exercises some 330 miles northeast of Puerto Rico. It will be a day no one will want to remember.
There was some kind of an explosion and fire in one of the USS Iowa's 16-inch gun turrets.
It must have been an awful explosion. All the power that was to send a one-ton shell 20 miles was turned inward, apparently setting off a ghastly chain reaction inside the turret.
The confirmed death toll remains at 47. And in addition, there were 10 to 12 minor injuries sustained by crewmen, primarily as a result of firefighting and damage control work after the explosion.
This now makes it the worst disaster aboard one of these battleships ever. The second worst disaster was when 43 died back in World War II. That was the USS Mississippi.
The damage was very clearly visible. The number two turret was pointed to the starboard position as it was during the firing exercises. The center gun where the explosion occurred was in the lowered position, and there was a burnt and blackened area along the wooden deck.
Great tragedy and matter of terrible sadness, and I don't care to say any more about it right now, but I will take this opportunity to express my regrets, especially to the families.
When they found out that the list had come out, that they knew that they would start picking girls out and taking them out of the room, it just got really quiet in there. They shut the doors and everybody were holding on to each other. You could hear a pin drop in the room.
The caskets bearing the remains of the 47 sailors were brought to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where the first of a series of memorial services was held. The Secretary of the Navy was among those eulogizing the victims.
It is our prayer today that they will go from here to their resting places, certain in the knowledge that a grateful nation will not forget.
Navy Secretary William Ball said he knew some of these men. Looking out over five rows of neatly aligned, flag-draped caskets, Ball said, "I shook their greasy hands and felt the powerful grip of a gunner's mate." He said they were proud of their ship, proud of their shipmates and their captain, but most of all, they were proud of their ability. And then at the end, Secretary Ball walked over to one of the caskets and knelt down in front of it before leaving.
The worst is to come. The last day, you know, that's the worst. You know, when you put them under the ground.
We have a full-time casualty assistance calls officer assigned to each one, each family. And we'll follow on with this through the weeks ahead and make sure that their needs are taken care of.
Obviously, there'll be a very complete investigation to find out exactly what transpired.
Analysts say investigators will focus on possible faulty wiring, a malfunction of the triggering mechanism, or on any way a spark could have accidentally been produced.
ABC's John McQuethy, who says that opinions also differ on whether it's time to modernize the huge guns, which have been a mainstay of Iowa-class battleships since World War II. Closing arguments were presented in the trial of Oliver North, the former national security aide accused of wrongdoing in the Iran-Contra affair. The jury heard the prosecutor invoke the Bible and Adolf Hitler in painting North as a habitual liar, while his defense attorney charged that the prosecution was off track and running wild in its attempt to win a conviction. The case went to the jury on Friday. And as Herbert Kaplow reported,
it's anybody's guess how long it'll take for the jury to reach a verdict. There are 12 counts against North to consider, some of them rather complicated. The counts include lying to Congress, obstructing a government inquiry, taking an illegal gratuity, converting traveler's checks to personal use, and tax fraud conspiracy. The jury is comprised of 9 women and 3 men, all black. The majority of the population of the District of Columbia is black. The jury heard about 8 weeks of testimony, something close to 50 witnesses, with North himself on the witness stand for several days. Some key points of his testimony conflicted with the testimony from his former boss, Robert McFarlane. Herbert Kaplow, ABC News, Washington.
The Saudi Arabian man who allegedly played a major part in the Iran-Contra arms-for-money deal ran afoul of the law in Switzerland. ABC's Lisa Rowland says he was arrested on a warrant from the United States.
Businessman Adnan Khashoggi was picked up at the luxurious Schweizerhof Hotel in Bern and taken to the local jail. Information officer for the Federal Department of Justice and Police, York Kistler, told ABC News Khashoggi was booked on two charges.
Kistler says they involve the former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos and his wife.
In particular, he's said to have helped the Marcos couple to sort of hide property in Manhattan and paintings which they took with them when they left the Philippines from the National Art Gallery in Manila.
Manila was the scene of a shooting involving a U.S. Army officer. Colonel James Nick Rowe was shot to death as he headed for work at a military compound. Rowe was a prisoner of war in Vietnam before escaping on New Year's Eve of 1968. And U.S. Ambassador Nicholas Platt made note of that.
In Nick Rowe, the United States has lost a genuine hero. No stranger to sacrifice on behalf of his strong beliefs in democracy and freedom. He spent 5 years as a prisoner of war and was heavily decorated for his service. Today, Nick Rowe made the ultimate sacrifice.
Communist rebels said they were responsible. Ambassador Platt called Rowe's murder an act of terrorism, which in no way will alter U.S. policy in support of the Philippine government. New developments in those voodoo murders we reported a week ago. Mexican police say they found altars, blood-spattered walls, and animal remains at two homes owned by the suspected cult leader. And at a site near Matamoros,
two more bodies were discovered out there close to the Santa Elena Ranch where the other original 13 bodies were found.
But Deputy Sheriff R.C. Williams adds,
these people were not sacrificed. However, they were killed by the same people, but it was a drug-related killing.
Authorities on both sides of the Texas-Mexico border are still trying to round up all the members of the drug ring believed responsible for the killings. As for those brutal murders in California's wine country, the worst fears of police were realized when the three young daughters of the suspect were found in a rock quarry near Petaluma. A local man, Mike Miskill, made the discovery.
The picture just looked really weird. It was strange. You're seeing two dead bodies with a little girl sitting next to him. And so I asked her where mommy was, and she started crying, just little whimperings. When she was talking, the voice wasn't coming out of her mouth. It was coming out of her throat.
That's because the child's throat had been slashed, she says, by her father, something that Sonoma County Sheriff Richard Michelson can't understand.
It's hard to comprehend that another human being could, especially a father, could cut the throats of his three young children.
The surviving daughter, Carmina Salcido, was taken to Petaluma Valley Hospital, where visitors came in droves.
We've had an incredible emotional outpouring on the part of the community. This is such a sad story, and people are calling, asking what they can do. Some people have brought by new stuffed toys and that sort of thing for her.
And hospital spokeswoman Mary Frost says little Carmina has perked up in spite of her ordeal.
She has been interacting with staff very well. She's been smiling and enjoying the fact that she can have popsicles, and she's off of the IV and actually having soft foods, and she's real happy about that.
The hospital will throw a party for Carmina's third birthday on Monday. As for the girl's father, Steve Tokens of the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City told us,
Ramon Salcido was arrested near to Ciudad Obregón, which is on the California Bay coast of Mexico. He comes from that area. He was arrested approximately 20 miles from that city.
Salcido was extradited to this country within a day of his capture, and his arrival at the Sonoma County Jail was greeted by an angry mob. Salcido was arraigned on 7 murder charges. He entered no plea. Police say because inmates at the jail threatened him, he's been put in an isolated cell. The natural curiosity of a child and someone's twisted mind combined to seriously injure a 5-year-old Indianapolis girl. It happened as Erin Bauer shopped with her mother. The child reached for one of those pump-type toothpaste dispensers, and it blew up.
She had some shrapnel like injuries to her face and abdomen. She had a rather serious injury to her left eye. And the blast severed 4 fingers and about half of the palm of her left hand.
That's Carol Hone of Methodist Hospital, who says that doctors could not reattach Sharon's fingers. They're also worried about the sight in her damaged eye. Indianapolis police don't know who put the bomb in the store or why. This was just one of many services held during the week in memory of the 95 people killed in last week's soccer stadium disaster in Sheffield, England. Everything from the police, the fans, and the stadium construction is being blamed for the tragedy. And Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher promises...
There will, of course, be a public inquiry. It is a disaster of enormous proportions, coming on the top of previous disasters, coming on the top of many precautions which have already been taken, but which clearly have not been enough.
The people were crushed to death when a crowd without tickets surged forward and caused a fence to collapse. For almost a year now, the House Ethics Committee has been looking into the financial dealings of its most powerful member, Speaker Jim Wright. The committee's verdict was delivered by its chairman, Democrat Julian Dixon of California.
The committee voted a statement of alleged violation on five counts, which includes 69 where we have reason to believe that Speaker Wright violated the Code of Official Conduct or other House rules.
And on my heart, I have not violated any of the rules of that institution.
And Wright went before all the Democratic members of the House to respond to the charges.
I told my colleagues that I intend to go before the committee at the very earliest possible moment to answer these charges and prove that they are unfounded.
Wright apparently impressed some members, such as Maryland's Kwasi and Fume.
The Speaker made a very convincing argument in his own behalf. It was something that the Democratic caucus obviously needed to hear, and something now that I think the committee needs to hear.
But as far as Montana's Pat Williams is concerned...
I think the Speaker is in the hip-deep water, and the White Rapids are straight ahead of him.
Some of the charges involved Wright's wife, and she, too, has gone on the offensive to defend herself. Exxon's offensive against its big oil spill in Alaska has a timetable, the company saying it plans to hire 4,000 people to scrub 300 miles of shoreline, and that it expects the job to be done by September. Meantime, the Senate began hearings into the March 24th tanker accident amid such charges as this, leveled by Rhode Island Democrat John Chafee.
Cleanup crews initially responding to this spill acted more like the Keystone Cops than the well-trained oil spill response team described in the industry's contingency plan.
Exxon President William Stevens took exception.
We are being charged, if you will, on slow and inadequate response. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to set the record straight that it's a lot more complex than just Exxon.
Senate Democratic Leader George Mitchell believes part of the blame rests with the White House.
The administration was slow to comprehend the magnitude of this disaster and did not promptly exhibit the needed sense of urgency in responding to it. Valuable time, indeed the most valuable time, was lost.
Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner told Mitchell and the committee that it was the administration's belief that Exxon had the know-how, so the matter was left up to the company. But he acknowledged...
No one knows how, for sure, to clean up the beaches and islands in Prince William Sound and other areas. We are experimenting with three different methods to do it, but no one is sure which one is to done.
A huge Soviet oil skimming ship has joined the cleanup, and reporter Jim Pound explains how it'll work.
The vessel is capable of removing crude oil down to about 90 to 100 feet underneath the water. It has a very large capacity. Actually, on board, it could carry up to 2 million gallons of crude oil, and there's also a barge going along with it to be able to dump the oil off of the skimmer right onto a barge so it can be transported away.
Ever since the spill, gasoline prices have been going up, reaching their highest levels in more than 4 years, and leading senators such as Ohio's Howard Metzenbaum to say...
The American people think they're getting ripped off, and some of us, including me, think they're getting ripped off also.
But Exxon's Joe McMillan says...
Claims that recent increases in crude oil and petroleum prices are largely the result of the Valdez incident are incorrect. The Alaskan oil spill affected the supply of crude oil to the west coast of the United States for only a short period of time, and its effect on overall U.S. petroleum product prices was minimal in relation to other factors.
McMillan backed up by Deputy Energy Secretary Henson Moore, who says OPEC stabilized its prices, demand for oil increased, and that began a chain reaction.
In January of this year, the wholesale prices began long before the Valdez spill. Those wholesale prices were not felt at the market pump, at the retail pump, until later.
Retail prices, including those for gasoline, helped push consumer prices up by 0.5% last month. At the same time, higher interest rates pushed up by inflation knocked new housing construction down by almost 5.5% in March. Initial reports suggested that Abby Hoffman's death a week ago was due to natural causes. But the coroner in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, Dr. Thomas Roscoe, says an autopsy revealed that the radical leader of the 1960s committed suicide.
Abby Hoffman took a very large overdose of the prescription drug phenobarbital. Abby Hoffman died from the combined effects of the phenobarbital and alcohol.
A memorial service was held in Worcester, Massachusetts during the week. Worcester is where Hoffman began his activism. Dame Daphne du Maurier, whose gothic and romantic novels provided Hollywood with several movies, died at her home in Cornwall, England. She was 81. In Los Angeles, Lucille Ball went in the hospital for emergency surgery.
She underwent an open heart procedure that involved a replacement of her ascending aorta, aortic valve, and reimplanting her coronary arteries.
Dr. Robert Cass says the seven-hour operation went well, though, and the comedienne is recovering nicely. The hospital's been flooded with phone calls and get-well cards from Lucy's legion of fans. Last February, a court in Los Angeles awarded Rock Hudson's former lover nearly $22 million. Mark Christian had sued the late actor's estate on grounds that he'd never been told Hudson had AIDS. This past week, the judge reduced the award to $5.5 million. Attorney Harold Roden said there wasn't much they could do.
We're given the choice of accepting the cut or going through a new trial. Well, I talked to my client about it. I think it took about 3 seconds to make the decision. There's no money, there's no war chest for a new trial. He will accept the cut.
Part of the judge's decision was based on the fact that Mark Christian did not get AIDS from his relationship with Rock Hudson. The winds of change are blowing in the People's Republic of China. Student protests such as this one have been going on all week, with thousands of demonstrators demanding more freedom and democracy in China, which hasn't seen such public displays since the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. There have also been demonstrations in Poland. The chant for solidarity as a judge in the communist country ruled that the trade union is once again legal. Poland's recent liberalization, which includes its agreement to allow free elections, has led President Bush to propose a new economic aid plan for that country.
We will propose negotiations for a private business agreement with Poland to encourage cooperation between U.S. firms and Poland's private businesses.
Also proposed a new schedule for Poland to repay its international debt, which amounts to $39 billion. Jordan's King Hussein met with President Bush during the week, and as ABC's Chris Wright reported,
his outlook on the Middle East apparently brightened by 2 days of talks in Washington. Hussein declared he felt happier and more optimistic than he had in many years. Earlier in the visit, the king had expressed concerns about the administration-backed idea of Palestinian elections, but at the end of his talks, he raised no such objections. The idea of elections might be worth looking at, he said, if they were part of a whole process to settle the Arab-Israeli conflict.
King Hussein cut short his overseas trip to return to Jordan, where rioting over new austerity measures presented the most serious challenge to his government in years. Food, fuel, water, and electricity are all in short supply in Beirut, the result of heavy fighting between Christian and Muslim factions. ABC's Julie Flint is an old hand at covering life in the city, but even she had her doubts about being there.
I personally was absolutely terrified yesterday. For just 2 hours, the tiny heart of Muslim West Beirut, maybe 1 square mile, was peppered with mortars and rockets. It took me 2 hours to cover a distance of 0.5 mile from my home to the office, and in doing so, I saw 2 people killed and had 3 shells fall less than 50 yards in front of me.
Since the latest fighting began on March 14th, more than 250 people have been killed and another 1,000 wounded. Lottery fever swept Illinois last weekend as the biggest pot to date, nearly $70 million, was up for grabs. And as lottery director Sharon Sharp announced,
that prize was split by 4 winners who just struck gold, and they will receive more than $17 million apiece.
The excitement's building again. The nation's richest prize, more than $70 million, will be someone's, for the right numbers, in Pennsylvania this coming Wednesday. I'll check the winners in the Boston Marathon when World News This Week continues in a moment.
Mom, can you hear me? The doctor says you can't. But, I'm sorry, Mom, really sorry. I mean, how could I do this? I wouldn't hurt you, Mom. I love you. You make me crazy sometimes, but never like taking a knife, not cutting you. Hey, I wasn't on drugs, Mom. Believe me. I told you I... And I'm lying, Mom. You can't even hear me, and I'm lying again. But, Mom, I couldn't tell you. You and Dad would have killed me. You don't know about drugs. Parents don't know. You just make speeches. Well, it's not that easy. It's hard. They pressure you, tell you it's cool. And you get so cool, you don't even know how messed up you are. You don't know, Mom. Well, I guess you do now. I sure showed you, didn't I? Oh, God, Mom, please wake up. Talk to me. Please help me, Mom. Please help me.
The Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
One of the premier events on the marathon circuit was run during the week, and reporter Gil Santos watched the men's division winner cross the tape.
Now sprinting for the finish line, the winner of the 1989 Boston Marathon, Abebe McKinnon of Ethiopia.
McKinnon's time was the seventh fastest for the Boston race. Ingrid Christensen of Norway ran the third fastest time in the women's division. And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin. Engineering by Cy Kantrowitz and Tom Kennedy. I'm John Grimes, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.